The Sex Agenda podcast may contain references to sexual violence, sexual assault, or sexual oppression. Our listeners' well-being is our priority. Please feel free to tune out if you need to.
Hey!
Hello, 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 hello!
It's episode 3, Sex Agenda. So I hope everyone's good. We're actually recording this on International Women's Day.
We are.
So massive shout out to anybody that's organising around that.
Yeah.
And we did a little post on our social media just to highlight that, you know, International Women's Day came about due to inequality in work wages and organising around that. And there's still a lot of issues globally where people are fighting inequality, some of which we will get into with some of our chit chat today.
Yes. And in following the Twitter trend, I said today, what is International Women's Day if not women's oppression still persevering? So on that note.
Persevering indeed.
Yeah. On that note.
There's a lot of funny things happening, you know, some unnamed platforms encouraging us to buy sweat factory clothing on International Women's Day in the name of liberation. I am confused, but that's all right. We're all confused in this 2021. It's a confusing time. Anyway, in other news, to help us know if you like what we're doing and also fund future episodes, fund our work, we also have a survey feedback for our podcast, which we'll just be using to evaluate the podcast and our work around the Sex Agenda project generally. We've got a zine coming for lots of people, made submissions already. We've got some online workshops that we're going to do soon, so you'll be able to see our lovely faces. But yeah, fill out the survey. We'll link it to the references on our website. And we're also going to share it on social media. But like feeding back, letting us know if you like what we're chatting about or whether we're really pissing you off would also help. But if we're pissing you off, like just listen to another podcast.
Right, just unsubscribe. It's not that hard, babes. You know? We definitely are looking for feedback. Tell us what you're liking. We would also like to hear what other things you'd like us to do. The ideas we have for the Sex Agenda comes from like me, Annabelle, and the team, and that's like a specific, you know, kind of experience. So we're definitely open to people directing us to more people or topics that we could be talking about. And yeah, definitely please fill out the survey because it would really help our work moving forward. Thank you very much.
Amazing. So we're going to get into the section which has now unofficially been named The Mess, right? That's just like the unofficial title.
What is the official title? Section. News Stories. News Stories is the official title, aka The Mess.
Yeah, but that's boring. It's just mess now, like that we have to discuss. So something that was really striking that came out in the last week was, actually it was a couple of weeks ago, been on people's radar even more. Was a story done by the New York Times that focused on the access to contraception amongst Venezuelan women. It's been an ongoing thing that's been happening for years in terms of bad access to reproductive health, not just contraception, due to the worsening economic crisis, due to sanctions on Venezuela. But it's really got out of hand now. So this New York Times piece like outlined that around the capital, a pack of three condoms costs $4.40, which is three times Venezuelans' monthly minimum wage of $1.50, which is ridiculous. And we know the repercussions of poor reproductive access and particularly access to contraception. It's unplanned pregnancy. It's women dying in childbirth due to not being able to have safe birthing conditions. And this is the reality of what's happening in Venezuela. Venezuela also does not have access to legal abortion. So it's even more dangerous because the story highlighted the plight of women who have been trying to get contraception and are now on their like fifth, sixth child and cannot feed their family. So it's a horrible situation. I think it's something that really there should be international outcry about because people are losing their lives.
Yeah, and there has been a movement for a number of years. I'm someone who like politically has followed like sort of Venezuela's like political happenings for, you know, 6, 7, 8 years now. There has been a movement for years trying to change, you know, laws, particularly around abortion provision. I think it's worth knowing that the context of Venezuela, and like in lots of Latin American countries, is that the Catholic Church has a very powerful hold. So it's not just like people being able to access abortions, which is really important. And the fact that the law, you know, criminalizes to a point where people have to resort to backstreet abortions and end up losing their life. But there's also a sort of religious formation around there, in which, you know, people can't openly speak. You know, even the campaigns that have been happening in a number of years around, you know, relaxing the laws and giving women proper provision has been hampered in some ways. And we've talked about it. We talked about religion in the last episode, this religious way of life and the religious way of thinking about, you know, conception and birth and abortion and pregnancy and all of that. It's very sad to see, because like you were saying, you know, you have women that have multiple children and can't do anything to prevent not having more children that they can't look after. And sex is such like an important part of people's life. It's like an expression of oneself. It's pleasure, it's enjoyment, all of those things. People should not be deprived of those things. And it's very sad to see that the situation has been massively exacerbated by the US sanctions on Venezuela, which sadly last week Biden decided to carry on despite obviously what's happening. So I guess we'll continue to monitor the situation. And we did share a feminist organization in Venezuela that's campaigning and working around this issue on our social media. So people should definitely check it out and support.
Next up, article from the Metro, which is about how masturbation can help reduce period pain. According to a study that was done by the Menstruation Initiative, which is essentially, nice pun. Like essentially an organization founded by Lynette, which is a reusable menstrual cup, and Womanizer, a sex toy. So don't endorse these products in terms of we don't know too much about these specific products. However, they joined together to commission this study. What the study entailed was asking those that have period pains and usually take medication for their period pains to use a combination of sex toys and self-pleasure over 3 months to see if that improved their menstrual pain. And the outcome said that 43% of participants answered that medication was better, more effective. 42% said masturbation, and then 15% kind of said a mix of like both and other things like heat, CBD oils and exercise. 90% said they would recommend it to a friend. So very interesting study. I think obviously self-pleasure and masturbation is quite taboo. So it's something that people haven't really explored the whole effects of. But I guess the mechanism is that by pleasuring yourself, you're releasing good endorphins, oxytocin, dopamine, those kind of things that help calm the body, also relax people, reduce cramping, and that's what's causing an improvement in people's pain tolerance. So obviously won't work for everyone, may well not work particularly well for people that actually have gynecological conditions like endometriosis, where you have quite extreme pelvic pain. But I think well worth a try if it's something that you struggle with and everything else has kind of failed you. So the main link to the study findings, again, we'll put in our references, because it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. When I read it, I mean, I know people who suffer from really bad period pain who don't like to take medication and painkillers for it. So I guess this is alternative that people can try in order to relieve their symptoms. And I'm just happy to see like things like this being looked into. I think like we're moving in a positive direction where, you know, women's reproductive health and some of the issues that we have around it, you know, people are taking initiative to investigate what might or what might not work. And yeah, I think it's ultimately a positive thing. So masturbate your pain away, I say.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the study also picked up on it's not just pain, but like some of the other symptoms that people might experience. There was evidence it might improve, like in terms of diarrhea and like breast tenderness and those kind of things. So, you know, not a full blown conclusion because it was just like a small study. It's just one study. But like, I don't think there's much harm in giving it a try or using it alongside your pain relief as well if you have quite bad menstrual pain.
Okay, well, our next story is from Vox. It's a little bit of a long read, which I found like really, really interesting. And it's called This Week in TikTok, The Problem with the Cancel Porn Movement. So like, I'm on TikTok. I basically like use it to watch my I'm a Piano South African dance videos. And I follow a couple of like black people on there. They're like really funny. There's this guy that does like reaction videos and stuff. So I use it for like the really lighthearted stuff. So I haven't come across the like strong opinionated stuff. But this article was very interesting in the sense that I agree with the writer. There's a narrative around, oh, young people are being like pushed to like get into sex work. Young people are being told to enjoy these things because it makes them feel more liberated. So the writer talks about, you know, young people coming in and talking about their porn addiction, which is obviously a very real thing. But I sort of link it with, particularly when you have poor and inadequate sex education, the only other place that young people can get any semblance of what's going on or what sex looks like is porn. So like, I know America, in terms of its sex education, likes to do abstinence a lot. And I'm sure that's partly the reason why a lot of young people might go to porn to try and explain what's happening, what happens in that area, and can end up getting addicted to it. But yeah, it's very interesting. What did you think, Annabelle?
Yeah, so I don't have TikTok. I just feel like there's so much social media overload. I just, you know, I think you have to find some platforms that work for you, or, you know, duck out of some. And some people use all of them. But, you know, if you are somebody that has quite a few things to do, then I think it can actually just be quite toxic to your productivity. So it's one platform I've just not really got into. However, I am aware of things that are happening on TikTok through things that find themselves to other platforms like Instagram, and like things that are shared with me. The article was an interesting read. It's a longer read, which is helpful because I think the issue is complicated. One of the things that cropped up is how the cancel porn movement is, you know, very much centered around, again, you know, like partisan politics and like people saying, you know, very left-leaning feminists are almost coercing younger people into porn or pornography by like making sex so liberal and that kind of thing. The writer does talk about like choice feminism and those kind of things. So it looks at a lot of different issues. Some people in our collective have written about this issue extensively, like Almas, who's been on our podcast before, and discuss kind of, you know, the porn industry and ethics around it and that kind of thing. I think what I'd say is that there is bad porn in terms of and there's a lot of bad porn, and it's freely available on the internet, and that's really, I think, the main issue with the porn industry is that the worst porn that teaches, you know, negative sexual practices and things like that is the free stuff that is flooding the internet and causing quite a lot of issues. However, I don't think that means that all pornography is bad, but I think there has been a really poor kind of, you know, regulation around that. And completely agree with you that also people are searching for porn more that shouldn't be, because I don't think people are getting adequate sex education. So they go look for answers sometimes elsewhere. And it also means that people can't distinguish like things that are not really good for them to be watching because they haven't had any education kind of around that. You know, it's not really surprising that there's this movement happening on TikTok and, you know, on other platforms, and like this backlash, because as I said, like it's been an issue for some time. Like there is just more and more porn on the internet. And I think, you know, I think it was like a year ago now, obviously the government said that they were going to basically almost like put a licensing thing in porn and try and like block certain porn websites. And I think they tried to, and it just like didn't work, right? So people know that there needs to be better regulation of access to porn for some young people, but people just don't know how to do that. So the ultimate outcome is people just like calling for its complete cancellation, which is like one of those things, isn't it? Again, it's like, that's the thing that a lot of people lean into when people don't know how to regulate something, or that seems really labor intensive, that kind of thing. Sometimes people are like, we just have to outlaw it altogether.
Just wrap it,
you know, like, that's not realistic. So and you know, there is good porn that, you know, ticks the right boxes for a lot of people, and, you know, serves a purpose and is how some people get their pleasure. And if an adult of age wants to watch good porn, like, I don't really see what the problem is with that. But something else that came out today, and it will be going for 12 weeks. The government has launched a women's health survey. So include the link in our references. And essentially, it's a call for evidence. So they actually have quite a really simple survey for people to fill out for this. And they're collecting information around people's reproductive health experiences across the board, discussing some of the things we're going to get into with our guest shortly, you know, cervical screening, fibroids, sex education, all of these things. And I think it's really important that people fill out this survey, particularly people that come from more marginalized backgrounds, because we know outcomes amongst lower economic groups, people that are racially marginalized, people that LGBTQ are worse. This information is going to be used to, you know, shape our services in the future and for years to come. So if you have a moment, go and fill out the survey. I know there's been a lot of consultations of late, but this one's a particularly important one.
Absolutely. Yes. 100% agree.
We don't always agree, by the way, but I think we can agree on a survey.
On this occasion, I don't have anything to add, so I 100% agree.
On this occasion, we concur. So that's that, and we'll be speaking to Aisha Weber, our wonderful member of our collective.
You're listening to The Sex Agenda.
Really, really excited for this interview. I've been wanting to do it for ages. So we have the amazing Aisha Weber, who is a member of DC Collective and our administrative assistant. Aisha, she, her, is a passionate health advocate who became interested in sexual reproductive health outcomes after her experiences with contraception in her early 20s. In 2019, Aisha collaborated with Public Health England to raise awareness about the importance of cervical screening programs, following her cervical screening test revealing abnormal cells, and PHE, Public Health England, releasing stats around the 20-year low uptake in screening nationally, particularly in those aged 25 to 35 living in inner cities and from Black and Brown communities. In the winter of 2020, Aisha had a fibroid removed and only paid attention to the increased discomfort after experiences with abnormal cervical cells. So, gonna get into it with Aisha in a bit, but just for a bit of context, I'll just give you a little bit of a reproductive health teach. So many listeners that do have and have gone for cervical screening before will be aware of what it is. For those that are not aware, it is a screening test. So a test that checks for precancerous changes on the cervix. And the way it does that is it tests initially now for something called HPV, human papillomavirus, and the strains most likely to lead to cervical cancer on the test. And then if you're positive for that, it looks for abnormal cells. And the way you have a cervical screen is usually at a GP, sometimes a sexual health clinic. You have an examination with a speculum, and then a brush is used to take a swab from the cervix, which is the entrance of the womb. And most people start having screening at 25 to 64, and it happens every 3 years until 50, and then it happens every 5 years. And then for those that are HIV positive, they have one annually, just because they're a bit higher risk of developing abnormal precancerous changes. So that's a bit of a teach about cervical screening. And then I'm just going to say a few lines about fibroids. So fibroids are non-cancerous growths that develop in and around the womb. They can be of different sizes, but if they get very large, then sometimes you have more complications. So that can include heavy periods, sometimes pain, sometimes trouble with the bladder, going to the toilet more often, sometimes constipation and painful intercourse. So that's a little bit about fibroids. But now I'd like to get into it with the wonderful Aisha. So welcome, welcome, welcome. Thanks for listening to my spiel.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here, Aisha. And you will be the first person from the collective to join us in this season. So shout out to you.
Everybody else, jump on.
The people are so sweet in the group chat about the podcast. Honestly, I'm like, oh, wow, you guys are so nice. But anyway, So Aisha, thank you so much again for being here and for taking time out to come and kick it with us. Just wanted you to tell us a little bit about what you do, what your interests and passions are. Obviously, we said your bio, but, you know, we'd just like to hear it from you, you know, what you do and what your interests are.
So more recently, I'm a virtual assistant, so assisting organizations like DC and others who are creating spaces for Black and Brown people in the UK. Basically, that's what I do full time. My interests have kind of like meandered over the past 2.5 years. I've picked up an interest in astrology more recently. What am I currently passionate about? Oh gosh, my rest. I'm just enjoying.
I'm just like rest, guys.
I'll be honest though, after what I have called unlovingly being the tenant, I'm actually excited to find out what my new passions are. We'll go into it later, but yeah, I was having a lot of like abdominal and leg pain. So once the outside opens, I might try like some horse riding. That's something that's on my list. Just want to try different things.
Nice. That sounds lovely. Yeah. So can you tell us a bit more about particularly like what led you into like entering the space and doing the work that you did specifically with like Public Health England and around like cervical screening?
Yeah. So when I had my second cervical screening test done, I was 28. The results came back as abnormal. And I went on to Joe Cervical Trust just to like find out information. They have really useful information there. Okay. So after my treatment, so I went through like the process within like 3 months. So the abnormal cells were released. So with GDPR, I just sent them kind of like, I gave them like feedback. They asked if they could keep my details on file. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I think February 2019, I got an email saying, oh, you know, can we just have like a statement from you because of the national statistics that Annabelle shared? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, maybe it'll just be like a one-liner in one of these red top newspapers. And then it came a point where it was like, oh, you're one of the case studies. Oh, you are the case study for low uptake in Black and Brown communities, 25 to 35.
How did that make you feel?
I was in the middle of a master's that I didn't finish. I had a lot of time on my hands and I was like, oh yeah, whatever, you know, I'll just show up in my trainers and my leggings. It wasn't until I got home from like Manchester BBC Morning and my mom and my dad, they had so many WhatsApp messages, aunties sending them videos. Oh girl, my gosh, your daughter
is talking about... You can never go on TV without your whole family knowing about it, even if you try. Next thing you know, there's like sideways recordings of you and all.
The thing is, it was so funny because I think most African and Asian and Caribbean parents, they dream of seeing their children on TV, not talking about your genitals though.
I mean, even when you're talking about racism, they don't like it because then they're like a bit scared for you. They're like, oh, they're gonna beat you up. And it's a lot of
It was just one of those things. So to be honest, for me, I was just like, at the time, like all my social media was private. So people just DMing me, asking me questions about their screening. It just really opened up conversations for me. So I was just like, yeah, everyone just go everyone with a cervix, like, go get yourself screened, because like, we don't really need to be having these cells turn cancerous in us.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, you have been such an amazing advocate, and you're always like jumping on social media and like partnering with organizations like Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust to raise awareness. So for a bit of context, my own story. So I think it was my first smear, I had to go for colposcopy testing, which is where if you have HPV, it used to be if you had HPV, the virus, and I think slightly abnormal cells, then you got sent to colposcopy. Like, the threshold has changed slightly, so less people have to have that invasive testing. So they did a camera test on my cervix. Everything was fine in my case. But I had such a weird experience, because there was a doctor there, and there was what we like to call an African auntie who was assisting in the clinic. And I did write an article about this, about smear fear. I think it was, I can't remember that website that got defunct, but I'll link it. And essentially, during my colposcopy, so speculum in my vagina, doctor looking at my cervix, this auntie was like, "I think I know your dad." I was like, sorry,
this is inappropriate.
Sorry. Because for context, my dad's a doctor. So I'm assuming she meant in a professional capacity, maybe because she saw my surname. I just honestly was like, left the consultation. Like, it was perfectly, how can I say, pleasant otherwise. But I was like, what was that?
Why?
I was like, that was not comfortable. So anyway, it could have been a comedy sketch.
It sounds like one.
Not the right setup. So yes. Tell us about your experience, and obviously you had to have repeats and things like that and treatment. So how was that process?
I think I discussed this with you, Annabelle, like a year or so ago, that I got a phone call, I think 3 or 4 days after, only because I think like the medical secretary wasn't sure if I'll get the letter in time. So they wanted me to come in on the Monday. So I went in on the Monday, had a chat with a gynecologist, then they booked me in for a colposcopy. Went in for that maybe a week later. Biopsy results came back within about a week or two. And I was just told, are you available in the next 3 weeks? Because we could have a cancellation or we could have availability. So I had my cervical screening test done end of July. I had the abnormal cells removed end of October, so relatively quite quickly. And also the gynecologist who removed those abnormal cells, one of my friends had actually done her rotation with him at Lewisham Hospital. So I remember she asked, oh, you know, you're going to Lewisham, who's the gynecologist? And I told her who it was, and she was like, oh, he's great. So yeah, in and out. It was like a 10-minute procedure, a day procedure. What was really nice though, a lot of the medical staff were just like, good on you. Good that you came in. One of the nurses, when I went in for my pre-op, was like, I hope you told your mates, like, make sure your mates come in and, you know, make sure they're up to date, et cetera, et cetera. So that was end of October. Then I went in for my 6-month follow-up in May 2019, I think it was. Yeah. About May-ish, no HPV, and then I went back into, you know, the rotation of every 3 years. So I think I should be due for my next one.
Thanks for sharing. And I think just a few more questions, because I know that a lot of people have worries beyond the procedure, which, you know, people are worried about going because of being examined, having someone that you're not familiar with look at your genitals. But I also think people are worried about, like, what if they require treatment? What that means for them in terms of there's really good evidence now that if you get pregnant, that I think people worried that if a bit of your cervix is removed to prevent it developing into cervical cancer, that what that does that mean for pregnancy and things like that. So is that something that you were counseled on at the time?
Yes. So actually, I think my pre-op assessment and my mom was just adamant, like, I need to go with you. I need to go with you. And I was like, okay, come with me. And she asked those questions. The gynecologist was great. He was just like, you know, if you choose to become pregnant, when you choose to become pregnant, as soon as you find out, just make your team aware and like a stitch will be put in my cervix. And again, you know, in black and brown communities, I was like, respectfully, sir, I'm not really fussed about childbearing. He was like, if you change your mind. And I was like, okay, everyone get, you know,
was everyone your agreement in the consultation when you're like, I'm not worried about childbearing. Every time I say that, I feel like my mom wants to jump through the phone and just like go blows with me, to be totally
mom, like, you know, and you know when they start, you know, regardless of like whatever their faith is, you know, you hear them mumbling a prayer or like rebuking whatever, and I'm just like,
God forbid.
Honestly, it's just, it's, you know, so for context for listeners that might not have this background or experience, for example, you might just, you know, see a relative that you haven't seen for ages and you are just minding your business, watching your TV on your parents' sofa. And it just goes into, you know, I hope for you that you will have four children. Children will have many children in the name of Jesus.
Amen. So,
you're just wanting to watch your Netflix, you know, but it's seen as blessings on blessings. But yeah, I think that can be a real challenge for people because they're worried about like what that means for like their fertility and ability to have children. And actually, I think since you had your treatment, there's been more evidence that kind of shows that actually there's, you know, not really a significant higher risk of miscarriage. The cervix is fine in pregnancy. A lot of people don't need what you're talking about, that stitch, if you have treatment. And that's only a real small number of cases that need treatment, like yourself, Aisha, and need some of the cervix removing. So it's better to know than not know.
Yeah.
So go for your screening. More recently, as I mentioned in the intro, you had what is called a myomectomy, so a fibroid removed from your womb. Do you mind sharing that experience and kind of like what led up to that?
I think my GP would have thought, oh my goodness, this woman just wants a full MOT. So in between the removal of the abnormal cells and my follow-up, you know, I was monitoring my cycle and I realized that I was having a lot of pain just after ovulation. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe my body will calm down. And then I started having like severe cramping, like 20 days of a month. And I was like, okay, this is not right. And I started limping and some of the other symptoms you mentioned, like constipation and bloating. So I asked my GP for an ultrasound. And yes, there was a fibroid at the back of my uterus on the left side. So it was just a case of what do I want to do with it? Again, sent me to another consultant and I said, please, can I have it removed? This is pre-COVID. So it was a case of you'll be on 6 to 8 weeks bed rest. You won't be able to socialize, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, this thing is causing me so much pain. I was anemic. I now know, I don't know, Dr. Annabelle, you'll be able to shed any light on this. Severely underweight, so thankfully I've put on like a stone and a half since my operation. I had my pre-assessment January 2020, should have had it removed by Easter. We went into lockdown, so when we opened up again last September October, I was called in, and yeah, thankfully had it removed, you know, did the 6 to 8 week bed rest, and cycles a lot more easier, energy levels, sleep. There's just a whole list of, I feel like a new person. But yeah, bleeding 20 days a month. I was even, you know, on my cycle when I had my procedure done. So yeah, it was nice to see my consultant. He had got a lot more gray hairs since the last time I saw him.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing your experience, because I feel like stuff to do with, like, particularly with women's reproductive health, and particularly in our community, it's sort of like hush hush, like, right? Like, people aren't very open and honest and, like, you know, share enough information about what's going on, and trying to get rid of the, like, some of the bogeyman stuff, right? Particularly with fibroids. I think for me, like, my memory of growing up and knowing about fibroids, that, like, you were gonna die, because there were so many people, not just in my family but extended family, like, the conversations that I'd hear in the kitchen was that this person suffered with fibroids for X amount of years and then died. Like, that's the way that the conversation has always been framed. And I was just like, wow, this stuff's, like, really scary, right? So I think it's really good that with the experience that you've had, you're open and you're sharing that, so people can feel like, not these bogeyman thing. Like, if you're not feeling great, obviously we know that there are issues with the NHS and, you know, Black communities being able to advocate for themselves and also like heard, right? And also the things that they say being followed up on, that's definitely an issue. But I think what we're doing today is tackling the side in our community where there are just certain things that we don't talk about. Like, we only ever talk about the good bits, right? Like, when it comes to the not so great bits, it's just all like hush hush. And I think that doesn't help, right? I don't know what you feel like if you didn't have a space or a voice to be able to say this, how even harder it would be for you going through that, because it would literally just feel like you couldn't say, right? And I feel like for a lot of our, probably like our older, you know, our parents, our aunties and stuff like that, a lot of things just gets turned into, oh, hush hush, you can't say anything, where it's like people should share more. But I also understand why people can't always share, you know. I also understand that.
I would definitely say that I came across decolonizing contraception maybe a year and a few months before all of this. So I started to actually, like, engage with content that was like, okay, this is what's going on. Know your body, know the language. But also, I think for me, when it came to fibroids, when I heard about it from, like, my mom, my aunties, my cousins, it was, oh, you know, fibroids leading to, you know, baby loss, or fibroids and, like, blocking in terms of, like, conception, or fibroids and the heavy bleeding. And for me, watching my mum going to menopause and the multiple fibroids they removed from her, I was like, okay, I don't want the option of, like, the coil in order to limit the symptoms if I can.
So just for context, so I don't remember your point because I don't want to interrupt you too much. So for people that are listening that don't know, just jargon busting, coil, intrauterine device, the hormonal one, like the Mirena, levonorgestrel, releasing progesterone hormone into the womb to lighten the bleeding from fibroids. So it doesn't shrink them, but lightens the bleeding and helps people manage. And sometimes the fibroids will go on their own.
Yeah. So I just, because I knew that my mum had the coil, I just looked at it in terms of what my mom was going through. And then again, looking at myself at that time, I just turned 30. I'm thinking, okay, if I try and manage this for another 3 or 4 years, is that something that I really want? So I just thought, put me on the waiting. Let's see what happens. So actually my surgeon, when I did see him, Ghanaian surgeon, he was quite happy to see me. I think COVID had just changed his whole mindset, because he started going down, you know, the advice route of, well, it's not that large. It's not as large as other people have. Why don't you try and have a child first? And I just had to break it down to him, like, this is actually ruining my quality of life. Like, I can't tell you the amount of sick days that I took before I, you know, went freelance. So I just really broke it down to him and tried to explain. For him, he thought, oh, if I tell this millennial that she's going to be at home for 8 weeks, she's going to say no. But yeah, I had already been at home for like most of the year anyway. So I think definitely decolonizing contraception and just different content and the type of people who I tend to socialize with, it's more of a case of, I see my healthcare as a form of reparations for me personally.
So let's get into some of what you've said on a kind of deeper level. So I wrote an article for Black Ballad, who Aisha also works for in her administrative role, which is a website that publishes articles for Black women on fibroids and what is deemed kind of like women's hysteria, right? Your experience seems to be like quite good. You obviously, with your cervical screening and having that experience before, you were already acting as an advocate, so you could advocate for yourself and what you wanted regarding your fibroids. But I think something I've experienced, and I know people have concerns around, is A, feeling that they have these symptoms and not getting an ultrasound scan as you requested with your GP, and symptoms being allowed to linger. And then when you decide as a young person or a younger person that hasn't had children that you want treatment, people not really listening to you because they're worried about your reproduction and your fertility when your quality of your life is your kind of like primary concern. So I just wanted to ask you a bit about like your techniques for like advocating for yourself and what you feel like people can be doing as a patient really to make sure like their voices are being heard.
First of all, the NHS website. So actually knowing what your options are, having a good relationship with your GP. So a lot of my healthcare, I found that my female GP, Indian descent, was just the one who would listen. Wouldn't huff and puff to put through a referral. So I would just book appointments with her. And I did that for about 3 years. She was part-time and I would just always make sure that I'm able to see her because the male GP always used to fob me off. The other thing was, particularly when it comes to like, for those who have wombs, I went to my GP with the information that she would need. So I was tracking my cycle. I was unashamed in terms of saying certain symptoms. And I think sometimes our socialization means we don't talk about, you know, our poo, our urine, the bleeding, you know, the bleeding after sex. I told her everything. I was like, sis, this is what's going on. This is where it hurts. This is how it hurts. You know, the stool chart in terms of what does your poo look like? I just realized that that's how, like, especially your GP can tend to like filter you through the system and let you know where you should go. The same thing with the gynecologist for my fibroid. Even though I was looking at him and I was thinking he looks like one of my uncles, I just had to remind myself that I need this, and I couldn't be bashful to when he's telling me, you know, how painful am I passing clots. It's a bit, you know, it's a bit uncomfortable and you're like, oh, why am I telling this person all of this? But I had to give him the information. So I think what really helped me was actually knowing what would prick the ears of my GP.
Yeah, so I think that is really important, like, you know, familiarizing yourself with like the NHS website and the diagnosis. Just to flag that something that I was talking about this earlier this week was that, you know, the literary age in the UK is about 11. So the NHS website does aim its information like at a level where it's like quite basic understanding. But I think it makes us appreciate that why a lot of people do struggle to advocate for themselves and like accessible information. And often when they get a diagnosis, understanding what that means. For people that find that information is like not as detailed as they would like, you can also go to the NICE website, so the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, which has patient information, but also like guidelines for doctors. So you can know how your condition is supposed to be like managed in terms of guidelines. And if you don't understand it, you can like use that to ask questions and ask for like a more detailed explanation with your doctor. It sounds like you had a good rapport with your GP and your consultant. A lot of patients don't have that. I do tell patients that if you don't get on with the GP or they're not doing what you want, you can request to see someone else in the practice or go to another GP, register with another GP surgery and like look at reviews. Yourself or Edem, have any other tips from your experience like on that front?
I went to the gynecology department. I went in first and I saw the registrar, who was a Cypriot woman. She felt my lower abdomen. She did feel inside like my uterus. And just as I left, she kind of gave me like a wink as though, oh, this one knows what she's on about. It was 6 weeks before I saw the consultant. saw him, he basically confirmed everything that was that I had already told his registrar, gave me a pink leaflet about a myomectomy and told me to come back in a month. Went back a month later and he said, okay, so you're sure you want to be put on the waiting list for surgery? So it's one thing that I know that sometimes it can be recommended for people to sign up to a new GP, ask for a second opinion. Again, I think I was in a position where I was studying part-time. So I did have that flexibility and honestly the time to go to these appointments, to, you know, keep chasing up on the phone call or to go for blood tests, everything else. I find that sometimes it can be quite inconvenient for members of our community to actually continue to advocate. And sometimes you just, pre-COVID, people didn't have the time to go and drop off, I don't know, proof of address at the new GP, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's how sometimes it can fall by the wayside.
Yeah, no, definitely. And something we talk about as well, and we've seen like borne out with COVID, is how, you know, a lot of Black and Brown communities are working shift pattern jobs. So, you know, you don't have the autonomy that some other communities have about like taking time off and, you know, going to hospital appointments. So people often can't attend, sometimes forget to reschedule, get discharged and all of those kind of things. So that is definitely another challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to add just something like quite quickly. So I'm turning 28 this year, so I'm actually due for my next screening very soon. I had my first one when I was 25. In fact, I didn't even wait for them to send me a letter. I was like, ring, ring, ring. Hi. Can I come through, please? I rang them. They were like, oh, okay. Like, I remember the reception being like, oh, okay, then. I'm like, yeah, no, I want to get this done. And overall, it was like a really pleasant experience. Like, was chatting away with the person who did my swabs and all of that. And then my results did take a while to come, but when they came, my letter said that I have had abnormal cells, but it was nothing to worry about. So just wanted to add that, like, sometimes you will have abnormal cells, but obviously those type of abnormal cells are not anything that are like intruding your life or anything that they need to operate on, but they just like tell that to you that it came in your test results. So sometimes you can have abnormal cells and not require follow-up, like I didn't require follow-up. And yeah, and I'm looking forward to my next screen. Yeah, hopefully everything's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for that. So Aisha, you're just such an asset to reproductive advocacy across the board, and then obviously particularly for Black women. So really want to get your thoughts on what you think needs to be done to improve sexual and reproductive health services in the UK. We mentioned earlier Women's Health Survey, which was launched by the government on International Women's Day. So we'll link to that in our references. Just ask what we need to improve services, really.
Services. Brexit. Funding. I would say bridging, Dr. Annabelle, you've discussed this, and Adam, you've discussed this before, finding the intersection between mental health and sexual health within our communities. Because yeah, when it came down to my contraception, also the way that I advocated to have my fibroids removed, I had to draw upon the other areas of my healthcare. So making it clear to my surgeon that, for example, I am on antidepressants, and to be honest, having all of this bleeding and all the other symptoms of having this fibroid wasn't helping me in other areas of my healthcare. So I think to improve our sexual and reproductive healthcare, actually informing patients and service users, or even asking the questions around their mental health as well. So whether that's form of contraception, or, you know, practicing safe sex, or PrEP, or, you know, trans communities, all the intersections of our communities, I think having that conversation can be really helpful. The other improvement, I don't know where that fits on, you know, the government's agenda in terms of funding. So the availability of like out of hours or unsocial hours, sexual and reproductive health services, making it easier for home testing, and just education around safer sex earlier.
Because we do have it, but it's very like surface level. And my brother's 21, and over the last year, you know, we've had to brush up on some of the stuff that he knows about. I know with like the over-the-counter pill and all these other movements, I think it's just removing all of the barriers, but then also knowing that our sexual and reproductive health is just one part of our overall healthcare.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I as you said, we've talked about a few times, I think, on the podcast about the overlap between sexual and mental health and how there really does need to like be better connection between the two and understanding how it might not be like overt, but obviously sometimes people have poor sexual reproductive health outcomes because they were having poor mental health. So they can't go for screening, they can't go for STI testing, much like the rest of health. But, you know, with sexual health, the link is so intertwined because sometimes people might be using sex as a coping mechanism and like all of these kind of things, right? And I don't think that conversation is nearly wide enough. And I don't think the sectors really talk to each other in the way that they should. So definitely thanks for bringing that one up.
Yeah. And like Annabelle said, you're a brilliant community advocate. We need more people like you in our communities just talking about the experience and talking the ting, innit? Like, you know, because I just feel like there's just not, and I get it sometimes because like our culture, you know, we're socialized in a way that certain things are meant to be private, right? Like there are certain things that you should not say. It's like what you said earlier, is like my parents, I'm on TV talking about my private parts, right? Like some things are just never supposed to be open and talk about them, but it's like, but those things are causing people ill health, right? So it's actually really important for us to just have an open, frank and honest conversation. And like you said earlier, like sexual reproductive health has to include everything. Like, why aren't we being taught about, like, you know, I mean, so my year was the first year in school to get the vaccine, the cervical one. And I really had to talk my mom into letting me get it, you know. I was just like, I was a 13, 14 year old, like convincing my mom to allow me to get this thing. Because like, again, we've talked about this before and you both know this and are aware of this like narrative that like it gets balked in into sex. And my mom's thing was, well, you're not doing anything, so you don't need it. And I was like, it's not for now, it's for the future, unless you're just gonna pretend that I'm never gonna have sex. I mean, she pretends now that I don't work in sexual health. She's like, just don't tell anyone, it's okay, it's fine, just don't tell anyone. I'm like, I'll tell everyone. So I just think it's really important for us to have these conversations. And that's why I'm going to get really mushy now. I love doing this podcast and I'm just really excited about all the other guests we're going to have, because it's just things that we just don't talk about. And if some, you know, Edem somewhere is listening to this podcast and is feeling a little bit more, you know, empowered and feeling a bit more hopeful about the future, feeling a bit more like they can go to their GP or their doctor and really advocate for themselves, that I just think that we're doing a good job. So yeah, so I just got really mushy there.
No, and
I may be ovulating, who knows.
And Aisha, you absolutely brought up something else as well when you were speaking. You talked about Black women and menopause. And I just wanted to flag that we are going to do another episode on menopause with Karen Arthur in a future episode. So people listening,
great,
look out for that. Just to
talk about
up,
how mean my mum was to me. I think we need a support group for all the Black girls whose parents went through menopause. My mom was so mean to me. I talked to her about it now. She's like, no, it wasn't. I was like, no, you were horrible to me.
Oh, like, my goodness.
Now that I know what was going on with you, I get it. But still, like, it was not necessary.
She's been so much nicer since her hysterectomy, like, day and night.
I mean, I'm still in it, guys. Pray for me.
We need a support group. No, I'm being really serious, actually. We need a support group.
I'm a young mum. I was literally like, every time I speak to her, I'm like, how them flushes, they're still happening. We still getting periods. When will it end? When will it end? But it's important that we educate each other and we know about the struggle to come and that the reproductive health issues just don't end just like that. So you brought up a really good point. Also, you touched upon hysterectomy. We didn't really get into it, but we've talked about kind of like that whole issue where people don't really want to have hysterectomies in the Black community a lot because they feel like someone's taking their reproduction away and their reproductive autonomy and things like that. And they sometimes feel like nobody's offered them any other treatment, right? So people often feel like that's the narrative around fibroids. Like if you say that you have fibroids to a doctor, they're just going to be like, we need to cut your womb out. And that's like a huge issue. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's so much stuff going on this month. I'm like plugging so many stuff, but I'm also doing a panel on a film called Belly of the Beast, which talks about forced sterilizations in Californian prisons and predominantly on Black and Hispanic women. So definitely go and check that out. There's a link to it on the Barbican website, but we'll put it in the references. But to wind up, Aisha, you've been amazing, and honestly I think we could talk to you all day. You know, literally we could just sit here and chat. What are you working on at the moment? Like, what are you hoping to do in terms of this year 2021, which has scattered us already
again?
When I get my second vaccine, maybe I might leave the country. I need a holiday. But going back to what I mentioned about, for me and fibroids, I'm where the money resides this year. my savings are non-existent, and I'm really gonna enjoy having good iron levels and all this stuff that I took for granted in my early 20s.
The things that people have just on a normal day.
right now,
guys,
that...
value your metabolism, because honestly, I don't know what happens. You see 30, and your metabolism. You just eat Ben and Jerry's, palm, thicker than a sneaker.
But this is what I need to do. So for me, this year, I feel like most of my 20s, I was quite airy fairy. Oh my gosh, the community, etc., etc. Now that this fibroid is gone, I'm like, okay, what are we trying to do in the next year and a half? So for me, collaborating with folks like you, just work and keeping safe, all that good stuff. Because when outside opens, events and all this other good stuff. So, yeah, really, really doing baby girl and enjoyment.
Love it. We love that for you.
Yeah, we love that for you. And thank you so much for sharing and being amazing. And also, amazing person that once this lockdown finishes, you're saying that you're leaving your house to be doing something new. Me, I've done the opposite. I realized I no longer need to.
Annabelle's not leaving the house anymore.
People will be inviting me to do Zoom party. I'll be like, use a projector.
Do you know Annabelle and that disco ball that she puts up? That she'll be doing
from her house. She's like, I'm not leaving.
I will make my own party and I'll tell people to Zoom link me into the house party. People won't see me in person again. I've realized I don't like people. I don't like you.
I know, right? This lockdown. Thank you so much, my darlings. I'm going to leave you to record the rest.
No, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
To our growth section, and I thought that given the week and that, you know, it's actually International Women's Day but won't be when this comes out, we should have a bit of positivity. A book that I have been reading and I've really been enjoying is the book Women on Top of the World, which was edited by Lucy Ann Holmes. So the other title is What Women Think About When They're Having Sex. And honestly, I had no expectations when I started reading the book because it was given to me. And I'm so pleasantly surprised, not just as a nice read for myself, but also as an educational resource, because it's just got so many different stories about people's sexual experiences. And I think a book like this is so rare, and I do think it will help people realize, you know, how varied sexual experiences are. And obviously that's a huge part of our work and the work of the project we're on, the Sex Agenda, and making people understand that, you know, whatever your backgrounds or whatever, you can have the sex that you want to have, even if that means not having sex and those kind of things. So the quote that jumped out at me was this one that says, "Sometimes I think I have too many fantasies although I'm pretty sure you can't have too many. It's a nice one. What do you think of that quote?
I love it. No, I love it because it just speaks to, like, it just speaks to this thing that we're socialized with, particularly as like women, right? Is that sometimes I think have too many friends. So you're like question like your way of being, and then you're like, nah, man, it's all good.
And then,
it's all good.
It's all good. You can just dream up what makes you happy. And I also just liked it because, you know, we talk about how sex relates to loads of different facets of our life, and it also teaches about people and yourself. And actually, for me, that quote also really like talks to just like life. Fantasies don't always need to be sexual fantasies, right? They can be your fantasies and your expectations from life. Mm-hmm. And for me, I find that sometimes when I share my kind of fantasies and expectations and my dreams with people, they sometimes are surprised because maybe they're too big, right? Mm-hmm. And they're too mighty. And like, I just loved it because it was like, you know, if people want to limit their own expectations, and that's for you to do, but like, don't limit my expectations, you know. Absolutely. I want it all. I love life. I want it to be the best it could possibly be for me and other people. And you know, if you don't have those expectations and you haven't created or seen that there can be this fantasy of what, you know, life and world can be, then that's cool, but that's not me.
You can miss me with that. Miss me.
So yeah, miss me with that. So but no, it's such a good book. And as I said, I was so surprised because I started reading it with no expectations. I've still got a few of the personal stories left. And yeah, I think I'm really, there's a few books that, you know, we point to on our website.
Wait, did you get this book because you're writing a book?
Yeah. So I got sent it. I got
gifted. Oh, cool.
And again, like, I've only really ever got sent, like, you know, I think two or three books. And I just started reading it and thinking, oh, you know what? Actually, this is really good and people should know about this, because actually, because someone sent it to me, I was a bit like, Edom knows how I am. I don't really like, I get a bit like, please don't sell me stuff in like products and like people trying to promote things. So I was just a bit like, no, I just want to focus on people's reproductive and sexual health and well-being. But I was just like, actually, no, this book does really great work. And actually,
yeah.
I really think people should read it.
I'm gonna get an e-copy online. Sounds really exciting.
Yeah. So yeah, do have a read. Absolutely have loved this episode. Like,
yes, thank you for staying with us.
And go and fill out our podcast survey.
Yes, do. It's in the description.
No rude or naughty things.
Only in context, right?
I'm taking, but my girl's single, and we can do some numbers. No, you
trying to flog me on the podcast, Annabelle. God. Sound like my mother now. Jeez. Anyway, yes, please fill out the feedback. It will really help us in terms of our work, in terms of funding, and continue to do the work that we do. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and enjoy your week.
Bye.